This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and welcome to Health and Living with me, Lim Soo. And it is a Friday and we are back with our Doctor in the House series after a very short hiatus over which covered Raya Week as well. So of course, joining me in the studio today is my co-host, consultant urologist, Dr. George Lee. George, nice to have you back.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm glad you mentioned short hiatus because it really felt like a long time because, you know, missing the studios and missing you guys.
It's nice to have you back on the show. And today we are also joined by consultant pediatrician, Dr. Amar Singh. And we are talking about the celebration of Disability Days today. Now, every year we celebrate quite a number of them. We do that quite often on this show as well, such as World Autism Awareness Day in April, International Day of Persons with Disabilities in December. And of course, there are many, many more. Mm-hmm. These are important commemorative days. We often talk about the particular condition or issue that it's trying to highlight. It increases the visibility of people with disabilities and their rights. And it's often celebrated along with statements and promises to improve support and services for people with disabilities. But we want to talk about today whether there has been real progress made for the community and why we need more transparency and accountability from the government and from relevant ministries as well. Amar, thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Thank you, Suanne and George. Good to be here with you.
Yeah, Amar, it's a heavy subject, but I'm sure you can enlighten us a lot about with this topic, really. But yes, very important, obviously.
I hope to have a frank discussion with both of you.
Yes. Indeed.
And for our listeners out there, if you have anything you'd like to share or if you have questions you'd like to ask, you can call us at 7733 2900. You can also WhatsApp our U mobile number at 018-789-8899, or you can also tweet us at BFM Radio. Now, Amar, I'm going to start by a very simple question, right? Why do we have these commemorative awareness days?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think many people don't understand that these days are not just Malaysian days, they are international days. And what's happened is that civil society all over the world has worked to bring this to the attention of the United Nations. And quite often the General Assembly will then have a resolution, a vote on whether we should have such a day. So many of these days are actually civil society initiated and then adopted by the UN General Assembly and then become international days. And I think they have three major functions. The first is to bring attention to underserved areas and areas where lack of attention, especially for different disabilities. Secondly, I think they then, by celebrating them, we bring awareness to the public, to the general society, to become more aware and understanding, more understanding about this problem. And thirdly, I think it pushes government agencies, authorities to act, or at least make promises that they will act about this issue and this condition.
So looking at these three functions that you've listed, Amar, you know, I want to look at the positive impact first. What have you seen in terms of the positive impact of commemorating these days and celebrating them, both from the public, both on the public and on policymakers?
I think that one of the first biggest impact is that it's a unifying impact. It's not just a geographical Malaysia unifying impact, but it's an international unifying. We're all celebrating the autism awareness period at the same time. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of cross-pollination between us and our colleagues in other countries. So I think it's inclusive generating, not just locally, but internationally. It's trying to bring us together, bring the world together. Secondly, I think there's an awareness component to it. In the past, maybe 30, 40 years ago, if you ask people, what do you know about disability? They might tell you deaf, blind, maybe Down syndrome and cerebral palsy. But today, people are well aware of autism. They might know about dyslexia. They're becoming aware of rare diseases and spinal muscular atrophy and other conditions like that. So I think it has brought into the public eye and the public mind that there are many other forms of disability. It's diverse. Mm-hmm. Thirdly, I think we've got more involvement by people without disability in the disability community. Right. Previously, disability community had looked after themselves. Now, I think with these days, there's been more involvement. You know, you might have an autism walk and lots of the community turn up for it, not just those with autism and similarly other activities like that. And finally, I think it's given a voice. It's given a voice to people with disability for us to listen to their lived experiences and hear what their issues are. I think the fourth one is perhaps the most important impact of these international days that we celebrate.
So then looking at on the other side, you know, which is what we want to talk about today, which are the gaps that it has highlighted, right? And advocates like yourself have also used these days, leveraged on them to highlight the lack of progress that we've seen within the system and with what policymakers often promise on these days. What examples have you seen, Amar, about how these days have simply been used for virtue signaling rather than, you know, as a launch pad for actual progress?
Thanks, Ren. George, I'm going to use an analogy from my experience in the civil service for many decades in health. Let's move away from disability for a moment. Quite often we have visits. We have a visit for a VIP or a minister to the hospital. And what will happen is quite often they will spruce up that areas we're going to visit. The place the minister is going to come is painted up, you know, it's cleaned up. Sometimes even patient volume is reduced. And then we come and see, showcase this great health service that we're doing. And then when they leave, everything goes back to square one. I call this the potted plant method.
All right.
And we do that quite often with people with disability. Mm-hmm. We bring them out like potted plants, array them around the minister or the government official, and then take nice pictures, have nice banner, make some promises. And then when it's finished, we put back our potted plants into the background and forget about them. So I think that's basically what I see very often happening. It's a hard truth, but it's an important truth to listen to.
But to play devil's advocate then, Amar, you know, does it matter if, you know, it's working towards raising awareness?
It's okay if there's progress, but quite often a lot of promises are made, sometimes promises in writing, but we don't seem to see the fulfillment of these promises, which is what we're looking for.
But in your experience, for how many years that has been celebrated, the same day it's been celebrated, can you name a few examples of what concrete evidence of progress that we made?
I think much of the progress has been done by civil society within government. Civil societies have been pushing for services. Civil society has developed services. I think, to be fair, I work in civil service. Government is trying. Government writes policy papers. Government tries to improve the services. But I think the change there, from our perspective, has been very slow and marginal.
I mean, another kind of devil's advocate here is, like, you know, in 365 days in a whole year, we choose one day to pick the potted plants approach again. And then all the listeners out there who listen to it, they might feel a bit passionate about it. 1 week from today, they might not remember anything of that. So is there real benefit? I know you highlighted those pillars, importance, advocacies and that sort of thing. Are we really making that much difference or for one day?
Well, again, I'll come back to you and George, and maybe come back to the person who's not a medical person like you and ask, do they know of new disabilities, different disabilities? And I think they do. So I think despite that we have a short media cycle and a short, social media cycle, we do tend to actually imbibe some of these issues. And if we keep speaking on a rights issue, keep talking about diversity and inclusivity, then I think these days build up together, not just a single day, but perhaps the Down Syndrome Day, the Autism Day, the World Disability Day, all build together with even other days that we talk about, maybe an Indigenous Rights Day and so on.
Yes. All right, we'll go for a quick break now and continue this discussion. When we come back on the show, with me today is consultant pediatrician Dr. Amar Singh, and of course my co-host consultant urologist Dr. George Lee. We are talking about the role of disability days and really the bigger picture of whether we're getting anywhere in advancing disability rights. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back on Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
Be free-minded. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to Health and Living with me, Lim Soo. And it is a Friday and you're tuned into an episode of our Doctor in the House series together with consultant urologist Dr. George Lee, my co-host. And today we are also joined over Zoom by consultant pediatrician Dr. Amar Singh, who has long been an advocate for disability rights here in Malaysia. Now, and of course, we are talking about the role of disability days and from there, whether they've helped us, advance disability rights in Malaysia. So before the break, we were talking about the function of these days and what impact we've seen from them so far, especially on the positive side. But from there, right, Amar, Broadly, how would you then describe the landscape of rights and support for PWDs in Malaysia? Because we use these days to make plans, to ask for change, but could you describe what the landscape looks like now?
I think that the saddest thing is that we are the weakest in progress and development for disability rights in our region.
Mm-hmm.
Let's not compare with New Zealand or the UK or somewhere. Let's compare with South Korea, with Taiwan, with India, with Thailand, Indonesia. We're probably 20 years behind many of these countries mm-hmm. in our disability rights. We've got some legislation in our OKU Rights Act, you know, but it is really not enforceable. Mm. And it's not in line with the CRPD, the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disability.
Mm.
If you just look, for example, at our infrastructure, our buildings, our environment, our transport, it's not disabled friendly. Despite having some codes, some guidelines that we should do this, because we have absolutely no enforcement, mm-hmm. we're actually not building a disability friendly environment. And every new building that comes up today, every transport system is just not disabled friendly, which is very different from our colleagues around. Notice I haven't even compared with Singapore, which is very much further ahead than us.
Mm-hmm.
Look at employment, for example. We've got a policy for more than 35 years that 1% of people employed in the civil service should be disabled. We haven't even achieved, we just achieved 0.3%. And the vast majority who apply don't even reach the interview stage. Something's wrong there. And for me as a pediatrician, very interested that children with disability get included in mainstream, and that's a failure on our part. We've done very poorly despite it, having very good targets. Mm-hmm. And finally, perhaps, let's look at long-term care. Let's look at the growing population who are aging, who are all becoming disabled. I mean, I'm 65. As you go older, you know that you're going to become disabled. Your hearing's not so good. Your mm-hmm. mobility is not so good. Huh? And our assisted living for people with disability, our aged care is all very poor. So mm-hmm. basically, we're not an inclusive society in Malaysia, and we are at least 20 years behind our neighbours, which is very sad.
Mm. Like what you mentioned, right, Amar, inclusion for people with disabilities, thinking of accessibility, that's often an afterthought in a lot of things, whether in our spaces, in our policies. How do we switch that around? How do we make that shift and mainstream disability inclusive policymaking?
I think if you want to mainstream disability inclusive policy, you need to have legislation. It has to be okay. mandated. It cannot be something that's optional. Every contractor, every architect must know that this is on board. You know?
Are these mandated in countries such as South Korea and Taiwan, which you mentioned?
Yes, it is. They have very, very good disability rights. We actually, in one of our articles to the media, we compare the legislation for many of these countries and show how far behind we have. They have disability tribunals where people can go and complain about the failure of civil service or any employer, anyone who is not meeting their disability rights. So I think it's very important that besides that, any government agency needs to recognize that 15% or 16% of the population is disabled. That's WHO, World Health Organization figures. We don't need local data per se. Of course, it'd be nice to get good local data. Not everybody wants to register as a disabled person for a variety of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So let's take WHO's figure of 16%. And then there are care partners, people who live with the people who are disabled because they're siblings or parents, plus people who care for them. So you can estimate that 30, 35% of Malaysian population is either disabled or intermittently related with disabled. So you need to plan that this is a reality. You plan for any program you're doing, any service running, any structure you're building, any transport that you're planning, you just factor this in and cater for these people. And when you do that, actually you cater then for children and you cater for the elderly, because these two groups actually need this kind of change, this kind of disability-friendly structure.
Mm-hmm.
I think thirdly, we need to get the people with disability involved in planning and decision-making. Right now, they may consult, which is one step improvement from the past. Ministries, agencies, government agencies may consult people with disability and say, hey, what do you think? But I think that's not a step enough. In many countries, they've moved it one step further, where the person with disability is actually in the planning, is in the decision-making within the civil service, within the government authorities. I mean, people with disability in power. I think that's mm-hmm. necessary. Finally, I think for the private sector that may think they're not involved, it's very, very good business to become disabled inclusive. Uh-huh. If you look at the valuable 500 companies, who are they? Apple, Google, Starbucks, all the rest that you can name are there. they focus especially on the disabled. Why? Because they know it's good business. The moment you're inclusive, the moment you create services and structures and physical structures that include the disabled, your business booms. So I think we need to recognize it also as good governance and good business.
Mm. But again, some people might point out, well, this is a very small percentage of our population. You know, shouldn't we cater more to the majority? And so there's less of a need to cater to persons with disabilities. How would you respond to that kind of argument?
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, that's very an argument that doesn't look at the data and the reality.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you look at the reality, the moment you become inclusive, you create an inclusive environment in inclusive services, what you do is you benefit all of society. Let me take a concrete example. There's very good data and studies that the moment you include children with disability in mainstream and offer them reasonable accommodation and some curriculum modification, everybody's academic achievement goes up. Can you imagine that?
Mm.
You put a child with autism in a class, all the other children's academic performance improves. Why? Because now the teacher changes the style of teaching, and that helps every child. Previously, the teacher was probably teaching the average student. Now the teacher is teaching everybody in the class differently. And mm-hmm. that's what we want. Huh? And so this data has shown that it actually goes all the way up to benefiting an inclusive society. So I think we begin then to accept diversity. Because we accept people with disability, we accept diversity. What am I talking about here? I'm talking about gender differences, ethnic differences, religion differences, you know, social class differences, age differences. So it actually promotes human rights in every other area. Sadly, I think in Malaysia, we seem to thrive on discrimination. Sadly, we thrive on fragmenting individuals, whereas disability is a mechanism where we can actually bring people together, and not just the disabled, but every other group that feels discriminated.
Why do you think that is the case in Malaysia? I mean, you know, you highlighted the evidence after evidence about the benefit and also the importance of inclusiveness. And why do you think Malaysian as a society, we have this culture of fragmentation?
And to add on to that, Amar, you know, what you mentioned earlier about people not wanting to register as OKU, what does that also say?
Mm.
Yeah, I think that, you know, this is a very loaded question, George. You know, we know the answer to it. You know, we know that we have leaders who try and divide us, because division is power. When you promote one particular group, then you actually create a power base, you know, for yourself. And that power base enables you to actually do things with that power that you have. Whereas for me, and for you, George, and Sue, and I'm sure we accept everybody. We accept everybody as our equal. Some people want to believe that they are above others. We mm-hmm. don't subscribe to that. Mm-hmm. So I think when you are become inclusive, some people lose power and they're not very excited with
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't some people want to register, Sue? I think there's so many negative connotations for registration. For example, if you got an OKU card as a child, you probably get pushed to special ed.
Mm-hmm.
And you cannot get inclusive education. I've done one study on that showing the reality of this, that the moment you got OKU card, the other parents look down on you. They don't want you in the class. The teachers look down on you. And why are you here? You should be in Pendidikan Khas. So that's a concrete example. Similarly, imagine if you're applying for a job and you put down there, I have an OKU card.
Mm-hmm.
I think immediately you won't even pass the paper part of your application. So I think there are many negative connotations right now in our country for registration.
In fact, I really think that is the source of the problem rather than, you know, from top down, because obviously divide and conquer is one strategy that we always assume that is at fault in government.
Mm-hmm.
But within ourselves, I think, you know, we are, as a society, we worry about this stigma of any differences in gender, in disease, in disability. And as a result of that, we discriminate ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So society-wise, it is already creating that. And that's why we don't have the voice in order to force legislations, in order to enforce all these laws to protect the disability.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's the case?
I think that's part of the case. I think, as I said, there's not going to be easy to get the kind of data you and I are looking for.
Mm-hmm.
Although we do have National Health Mobility data, which suggests disability rates are much higher than the ones who are registered. But I think a body like the World Health Authority, which quotes 16%, is a reliable body. It's across the board. And most likely, these rates are only going up because we've got an aging population. So I agree with you, Josh. To some extent, we tend to discriminate as a society. I've looked at a UNICEF study on disability, which shows that some people believe having a person with a disability in the family is a burden. Mm. And that's kind of mindset or the heart set that we need to change. But I do believe that authorities play an important role, that if we have good policies that are inclusive, we push for legislation that supports disability, I think we can actually turn this around. I think it's both, not one or the other.
Mm. So I know one of the main legislation that a lot of advocates, including yourself, have been talking about a lot, especially in recent years, is the Persons with Disabilities Act, or the ACTA OKU, because back in 2023, if I'm not mistaken, last year, it was promised that amendments were in the works, but we've yet to hear updates. What kind of change to the Act would you like to see, Amar, to improve things for people with disabilities and also their family members?
I think that, you know, what we'd like to see is something that the Women's Ministry, Women and Family Community Development Ministry, has already promised in their action plan, mm-hmm. that they will bring the Act online with the CRPD, the Convention mm-hmm. for Rights of People with Disabilities. So I think that's their promise. If they keep their promise, we'll be fine. And that would mean that now we would have, for example, a disability tribunal where people could refer to and say, you know, I have been discriminated here, and the tribunal will listen and have the power to actually act on behalf. The Disability Act would actually put in place the legislation we're talking about for a society, a structure, a physical structure in society that is barrier-free. So, you know, every building built would have be disability-friendly. Every school environment would be disability-friendly. So I think this Act is a critical part of the need right now in our society for change.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Do you see, I guess from an outside perspective, right, do you see enough inter-ministry collaboration? Because a lot of the things that you spoke about today is not something that just falls within KPWKM, right? It covers other ministries, transport, health, you know, everything.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think they do have inter-ministerial meetings, but we have actually been suggesting that KPWKM cannot handle this alone. It's just, there's too much under that ministry, actually. And we've been suggesting that it be broken up into four parts. And one part is keeping the need for social services, looking after poor and dealing with emergencies. But there are three other big areas: women, disability, and children. And perhaps we need three different commissions or three different agencies that are separate from the Women's Ministry that look after these three areas, and then they can work seamlessly interagency.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. On that note that you mentioned about having a disability tribunal, we have something related that came in from a listener. Anthony says that, "I agree with Dr. Amar. My partner's brother is OKU, has a slight learning disability. He gets rejected at every single job interview he goes to when he discloses that he is OKU. So when he doesn't disclose, he gets the job and then gets evaluated as a non-OKU person, which results in him getting abused at work, bosses yelling at him, calling him stupid, before then proceeding to fire him. Now, we went to the labor court and won once, but because the structural problems aren't solved, he's going through the same thing again." So I guess that points to what you said, Amar. It needs to be a structural thing, right?
Yes, I think so. I think then it forces employers to change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's this important word called reasonable accommodation. Mm-hmm. We're asking for reasonable accommodation. So perhaps if you're a person with, let's say, autism, for example, who's going to join a job place, you might need a bit of space. You might need to work with headphones that George is wearing right now to cut mm-hmm. off noise of your colleagues. Or you might need, maybe you're going to have a meltdown. You know, you have the capacity to take a 5-minute break, mm-hmm. you know, just to deal with the stress you're dealing with.
Yeah.
Or you might need your own private cubicle where you could do great work. And you might actually be the best accountant in the whole mm-hmm. Whole team because you're really good at crunching numbers. So I think we're asking for this kind of
consideration
into the Disability Act that, mm-hmm. that and encourages employers. In the end, we actually have to force employers to bring this on board.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, many companies overseas right now preferentially want to employ people with disability with certain skill sets because they're useful to the company. And mm-hmm. we need to recognize that as well.
Yeah, okay. Along the line of what Anthony was mentioning, is that they went to labor court once and won. It's the Labour Court at the moment has got enough legislations that actually protect the OKU at this moment?
I don't know enough, but George, but I would say from my colleagues that I worked with, lawyers, no. The answer is definitely a big no.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So really, it seems like it's a case-by-case basis, I think, George. And that unfortunately highlights the whole problem, right? Indeed. You can win one case, but you know, you move on, like Anthony said, you move on to the next job and mm-hmm. then it's all over again.
Indeed.
Mm. The other point you mentioned about Amar, or you emphasized quite a bit, was the importance of inclusive education. How vital is that in the long term when we're not looking at just the development of children, mm-hmm. but the well-being of society and at large?
You know, like what Amar mentioned earlier on, that you know, many schools and also teachers who are supposed to be protecting the children are actually obviously looking down and discriminating children with disability. Is that happening regularly?
Mm. Yeah, I think it's very, very common. You know, I wouldn't really blame teachers alone. I mean, if you're a teacher teaching a classroom of 30 or 40, and then now you need to take a child with a disability, you're concerned, you're anxious, and you're not sure you can cope, huh? And you don't receive any additional support. So, you know, it's tough for them. My dad was a teacher, so I always got to think about teachers. I mm-hmm. almost became a teacher as well. It was one mm-hmm. of my preferred occupations. So I would say that the system doesn't support the teachers for this. So for that reason, they are actually negative from the get-go, and HMs also don't want this. They worry about the prestige of the school dropping. You see, in the Malaysian Education Blueprint, we have a target of 75% inclusion by next year. Mm-hmm. We're not going to reach that target. MOE has got some data saying that they're reaching the target, but that data is actually not real on the ground because it doesn't take into account the volume of children with disability. It just takes into account the ones that they know about. So I think that if you want to have inclusive education, we need to take some major steps. And one major step is to transform our special education unit into an inclusive education unit. As long as you have the term special education unit, you're going to push children into special education. When you become an inclusive education unit, then you take all your resources, all your special education teachers, and you move them to the mainstream. So you're a mainstream teacher now, and now you have an assistant, a special education teacher who's coming in to help you with this one or two children in your classroom who are disabled, and you help them transition into the class. You know, that kind of thing is necessary. So I think that we can do this. Many countries have already done this and are doing very well. And those actually world-class countries who are doing this, I don't see a reason why we cannot also follow in these steps. Yeah.
Mm. Now, lack of resources, whether financial or human, is often brought up as a big problem when it comes to implementing new policies. And using inclusive education as an example, then, you know, will that be a challenge? Because we'll need money, we'll need human resources to train teachers to revamp our education system. Is that going to be a problem to changing things?
Yes, I do think we need to retrain teachers. Existing teachers do need training in universal design and universal methods to teach children so that they don't teach children in an average way. Mm-hmm. But I think money is not the key issue. The key issue is accountability.
Uh-huh.
Right now, we have a lot of plans out there. Look at the Ministry of Health Disability Action Plan and look at the Women's Ministry Action Plan, which are very good plans. But have they been fulfilled? You set targets for yourself. Have they been achieved? Huh? I think if we achieve those plans, all of us be very pleased. So I think what's more important than money is a lack of accountability in our government agencies, in our civil service right now. We need accountability. We need accountability to be transparent. And we need also periodic external audits. People who come in and say, okay, this is what you planned. Let's go and have a look and see what you do. We're not coming here to destroy you. We're coming here to critically evaluate and seeing how we can move forward.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, because no one can do this, no one can challenge them, we have what in medical terms we use ISQ, in status quo.
Mm-hmm.
Things continue. A new plan will be drawn up and nothing much is achieved on that. Sadly, mm-hmm. I would love to see. By the way, Sue Ann and George, my aim in life is all civil society organizations, all NGOs, are no longer necessary because the government is doing such a wonderful job. That is my dream.
Is it utopia we're heading to? Right.
Yeah, correct.
Amar, I mean, you mentioned accountability. Who do you think should impose that accountability on the government? Because, for example, MOE set this target of 75% inclusiveness.
Yeah.
And then year after year, we all know that it's not achieving that. So who is responsible to take this up and say, aha, you're not doing this right? And then, and who's supposed to constructively guide them to achieve that?
Basically, George, you're talking about basic governance 101. A good government will be one that fulfills its promises, sets good targets, has audits, makes its audits publicly available, and critically evaluates itself and says, we have achieved here and we have failed here. We're trying to do better. Please help us and work in partnership with us. That's good governance. Right now, people are more protective. They're more defensive about things. And we don't see their audits. We don't see their results. So it's largely civil society-driven criticisms or civil society-driven push on the government for change. But will the government listen? Can we force them to listen? I don't think we can. You know, we have no means to make them listen. So again, we come back to meaningful legislation that ties people down to making change.
And the issue is trust as well, right? If the government come out with publication to say, yeah, we achieved that 75%, how many of us actually believe that is the case in the ground?
Which is why it's very for government to work with civil society, not work in antagonism with civil society, but work with us and be honest. I think honesty is very important. The more honest we are, the more likely society is coming around to believe what government says. But right now, there is a trust deficit in government.
Yeah, hence the word transparency is crucial here, right?
Transparency and accountability. We'll go for another quick break, then come back to ask a few more questions of Dr. Amar, and we'll wrap up our discussion. You can still send your questions in or share your experiences. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or call us at 7733-2900. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back on Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
Be free-minded. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to Health and Living with me, Lim Su, and you are listening to an episode of our Doctor in the House series. And joining me in the studio today is consultant urologist Dr. George Lee, and joining us via Zoom is consultant pediatrician Dr. Amar Singh. We are talking about what needs to happen to improve disability rights and support here in Malaysia, looking beyond just commemorating different disabilities on particular days. These commemorative days are equally as important in raising awareness, in getting people's attention. But whatever promises that are made during these days, you know, especially by our policymakers, should be followed through. And we've been finding out about, you know, the importance of accountability and transparency right before the break, like you were asking Amar about, George. And I want to talk about, I want to continue that for a bit, Amar, you know, because when we talk about Malaysian politics, it's clearly a very volatile scene. Ministers change even within the same government. How do we ensure, what would you like to see then to ensure continuity and sustainability of these plans? You know, even when ministers change, these things still happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's where the civil service comes in. I think the civil service needs to see good plans must continue. Mm-hmm. And quite often ministers actually depend on the civil service to advise them what we should be promoting. But we noticed that many good plans just seem to die out, you know, like, you know, when our health minister proposed the National Autism Council, and that's now languishing. We don't know what's happened to it, you know, it's a couple of years. Even the National Dementia Plan from 2019 till now, such an important plan. We actually had no idea, no clue, despite a number of initiatives to resurrect it.
So much work has been put into that for
them. Yes, for both of them and others as well. So I think that's where the civil service is critical. I think they need to keep the eye on the ball. These are the key things we want to change. Sure, when ministers come and go, and ministers have their own focus and may want certain things, but the core issues must go on. And I think we hope that the civil service will be the one that to drive these things, because they're the ones that we pay with our taxpayers' dollars to get the service out there for us. Yeah.
So then what is the role of the policymakers of the ministries then?
When you mean policymakers,
And the ministers, sorry.
Okay. I think a good minister can do quite a bit, and we've had an occasional good health minister. You know, we've seen what a good health minister can do to us, you know, can galvanize us and give us hope. So I think the role of the health minister is to maybe better communicate these plans to all of us, I think, to advocate for the ones that are there. And perhaps a really wise good health minister could also see what areas are missing and say, hey, we also need to focus on these areas. But we cannot have politicians that just want to, you know, for example, I'm just continuing with health because I'm familiar with it, put up a hospital in one area because that's their constituency and they think that's good. No, we need to look at the bigger picture of where hospitals and health services are required. So I believe that's what policymakers do. And if you go internationally, you will see that policymakers actually listen to their civil service compatriots very closely.
And what can we do as the rakyat then, you know, from my perspective, from listeners' perspective, you know, we talk about, we talk about wanting to hold politicians accountable, but it also sometimes helps to feel like you're doing something, right? So I guess in light of all these disability days, but also the conversation on supporting people with disabilities, what can our listeners do?
I think, first of all, recognize and accept diversity and accept people with disability. Secondly, listen to them. Don't have preconceived ideas. Listen to them. Appreciate what they are saying. Thirdly, involve them. Don't make decisions for them. Involve them in the activities. Give them the power to chart their own direction. And then I think recognize they have much to contribute. They're not just recipients, I think. And finally, I think this thing that we learned from COVID, kita jaga kita. I think in Malaysian society, much of what happens is because Malaysians get together and make things happen. I think that's what I hope for disability, that people with and without disability will get together and make things happen for all of society.
And your message to policymakers who might be listening in?
Just fulfill your promises. I think you'll be very right. Your promises are good. Your plans are great. You know, just fulfill them and all of us be very happy. And we are there to support you. We're not your antagonists. We want what's good for the country and for people with disability.
And you, George, what have you taken away?
I know it's like my takeaway from all the last 40 minutes. I guess I heard many pessimism, kind of like about how many of all these awareness we've done, and now we're back to square one, how many ministers gone through. And I hear all that pessimism, but I have one thing, which is a kind of a beacon of hope, is your inspiration. It's like, you know, for your, you can hear in your passion voice that you're clearly fighting for the people who actually have, disability. And like what you said, we give them voice. And, you know, to be honest with you, when I looked at this, the questions for today's discussion, I said to Suanna that it's a very heavy subject. And then, and also the other thing, which, I've been doing this for 15 years, how many, you know, Awareness Day have we done? And then I said to myself, I said, what difference does it make when you have all these awareness days? And I really think at the end of today, I said to myself that we shouldn't give up. One of the things that we can make it whole thing worse is that we give up and we dilute the voice. Like you said, the most important thing is unity, to get all the like-minded people to get together. And only awareness and knowledge can bring down the stigma, and that can bring down the cultural discrimination that we impose on each other. And lastly, only through that, the unity and awareness can have that voice, and that voice can impose on the government in order to do what is right. And that's all it is. I think one word is that I'm not going to give up, and we continue to do Awareness Day. Hopefully, we bring that unity.
And we'll keep having these discussions. Sorry, Amar.
Yes, and I think BFM plays an important role. Please keep up the good work all of you are doing.
Thank you so much, and thank you for joining us for the discussion today, Amar.
Thank you.
I've been speaking to consultant pediatrician Dr. Amar Singh, and of course in the studio with me, consultant urologist Dr. George Lee as my co-host. You've been listening to Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.